In the news.
Welcome to the October 5th edition of the In The Now Show. This is your host, Slip Mode, along with the rest of the crew.
VR.
Bob.
Awesome. Alright, well, we have got a lot of interesting news and information for you this show. And, of course, we have a lot of people in the house, so that's definitely going to be a benefit for all of our listeners out there. And you may be hearing some strange sounds in the background while we're doing the show. And that's just Meme and VR playing with our little toys we have here on the set. Wow. All right. Well, I'm sure a lot of people already know about the story in the news talking about the anti-telemarketing list. For some reason, it was taken away where it, well, not really taken away, but the Federal Trade Commission seems to not have the authority to implement and enforce the National Do Not Call list. So I heard that that got overturned, but then I heard that there was an appeal. And the appeal went through, but now I'm hearing that the Do Not Call list is still not working. It's still not being used. I don't know. Has anybody heard any details on that?
Well, from what I know of how the court system works is once it gets, you know, it can be appealed and appealed and appealed, and once it gets up to the Supreme Court, and let's say they rule on it, and they say, no, it can't happen. Well, that can also be overturned by a supermajority vote of both the Congress, the House, and the Senate. And they, if they do like a 3/4, you know, over a 3/4 vote in favor of overturning the Supreme Court, then it goes into law anyway and it becomes effective.
Well, the thing is that, you know, despite whatever really, you know, encumbers, is that 50 million Americans pretty much said they don't want it.
Well, there's over 270 million Americans. And then there's,
it's like one out of every six Americans don't want it.
And then there's at least every American has at least maybe one phone line, possibly two, some have 10. So out of like almost say two, we could say, you know, 700 million phone lines there are in the country, only 50 million of them don't want to be called. So that's not even a majority.
You know, even the judge that ruled against the Federal Trade Commission, his number is actually on the do not call list.
I think it's pretty safe to say that nobody wants to hear from telemarketers. It's just that not everybody knows about it.
Well, it's been publicized so much that I'm not one to watch the news or read the paper anymore. And I know about it.
Yeah, but not a lot of people know about it. I mean, it's hard to get it to everybody. I'm sure there's people in, like, Bunkville, Idaho who don't know about it.
Well, they probably do what everybody else does and screens their phone calls.
Or they put the telezapper.
What's an answering machine?
They're the ones who say, we ain't interested.
Well, you know what? How hard is it to just say, I'm not interested, don't call me, and hang up? It's not that hard. I think it's the 50 million Americans whose name are on the list that are just, they're buyers.
They'd rather just not have to even pick up the phone for such a bogus phone call.
Well, then, what? Do they even pick up the phone in the first place, or do they screen all their calls anyway? They just want their house to be quiet, so why even have a phone line? Why even have a phone hooked up to it?
I don't think that's the case. Yeah, I mean, there may be some people that are like that, but I mean, in all honesty, don't you want to have the right to not be harassed? I mean, you have the right to not be harassed in your own home, so why can't you be not harassed in your own home through your telephone?
Well, what gets me, though, is, you know, if you've got caller ID and you're on a critical call, there's nothing more obnoxious than rapid-fire successions of caller ID beeps.
Yeah, I can see that. But at the same time, if you don't want to be harassed, there are ways of, you can have your number unlisted, you can make sure when you file any forms to check the little box that says, you know, please don't sell my name or don't contact me.
I will say, though, that I've gone so far as jumping through all the various hoops to contact the telemarketer.
Still doesn't work.
Well, junk faxes, for instance, they'll list a number. They'll say, if you don't want to receive this again, call this number. Problem is, you leave your number and they tell you there's a 30-day processing period. So you continue to be called for those 30 days. Then they just call you from another extension or another corporate entity within that company with a different phone number. And, I mean, they can make it go forever.
You know, good luck buying a new house. The minute you buy a new house, you know how many homeowners insurance people are going to be calling you? All of a sudden, you magically get called.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, people know that they need to come over and check to see if you want to do if you allow them to do your yard work. I mean, when you buy a new home, you get on so many freaking lists. You know, and it's just not buying a home; it's so many things.
Well, I think there's different approaches to telemarketing, and the most terrible of them all is that predictive dialer technology. You know, because these are not markets. You know, these are not measured known markets. These are just people, you know, systematically dialing through the full, you know,
permutations of all the numbers. Yeah. And they can be dialing 10 numbers at once.
It's so different than, you know, like Amazon selling your, you know, customer information, or you buy some specialty item and then they provide that list to someone else, which is very difficult to police. I mean, you can tell them not to call you, but the thing is, your number's all over the place.
Yeah, it's already been sold.
The companies get sold to another company, and, you know.
Yeah. So, you know, I wish I had the news to say what's really going on with that to report it, but I'm not sure. You know, I think it's going to come through. If it doesn't, I mean, what the hell does that say about 50 million voices trying to get heard?
I'd be honest with you. I'm a little nervous that it seems to have the administration's support. Just to be the devil's advocate, I have to wonder, will it end up not being used against the corporate harassers, but somebody who calls the wrong phone number and the cops decide they don't like you. Now they got you because they got a call log where you called somebody that's on that list.
Yeah.
Well, that's the problem with everything. It seems like all these features can always be used against you, and that's... I guess that's why we have this show, because there's just too much stuff going on at one time, and we try to do our best to talk about.
Yeah, I think only like 5 people voted against it in the Senate.
Out of what, 95, 98 people?
No, or is it Congress where there's 200 and some? No, it was like 95 to, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
95 to 0.
To like 2 or something like that, or 5, something like that. Yeah,
it's like 5.
Pretty great stuff. All
which
right.
I don't think there's ever been a vote quite like that before, except for the Declaration of War, where only one voted against it.
Yeah.
And the Patriot Act. Yeah. Everybody voted for the Patriot Act.
Except for the legalization of marijuana, it was kind of backwards. It's like 95 no, 5 yes.
Yeah.
No, just kidding.
They made us vote on that one twice, if I remember correctly. You know,
yeah.
Remember that, the Prop 200? They said, oh, well, the voters got swindled. They didn't have enough brains to understand, so I'm going to do it again.
Yeah. All right. This is another interesting bit of information. A lot of people don't know it, but every car, I think, since the year 1992 has been manufactured with a little black box. And that little black box keeps some information on your car that sometimes can be used against you or against somebody else in an accident. It might be, it might save your day, or it might give you a rainy day. A little publicized privacy bill signed into law Monday, which was back in late September, aims to protect California motorists from a little-known device dubbed as the black box that records data on how a vehicle has been driven during and before an accident. The legislation, the first of its kind in the nation, prevents the recorded data from being obtained by police or others without the vehicle owner's consent or a court order, except in cases of safety research in which the owner's identity is protected. The law, which takes place effectively July 1st, 2004, also requires automakers to disclose the presence of the devices in the owner's manual.
Ooh.
It's kind of like pleading the fifth.
I just realized something. Ashcroft just said that they're going to have 30 million people in prison instead of the paltry 2 million that they have now. Now I know how they're going to do it.
Oh, they're just
going to data mine their way into locking us all
They're
up.
Just going to be walking down the street plugging into the little black boxes. Oh, you've exceeded
the speed
limit. You were
going 80 miles an hour earlier.
Yeah.
I mean, they're literally going to take law enforcement to a new level. They're just going to dredge and pick everybody up for anything.
Well, that's if you listen to the October 1st edition of Off the Hook, caller brought up this thing. He's like, "Oh, do you know about these devices?" And basically the radio devices, the radio chips that they put on, like Walmart,
RFID tags
that they want to put on products, and they do put on prisoners. And they put on dogs. One person in
Applied
New York...
Applied Digital Solutions, by the way, is the company that makes that, and they are a subsidiary of IBM, and they already are under contract by the People's Republic of China to make chips for people.
Yeah, they already have chips for people.
Yeah, some guy from England that did it voluntarily.
And one of the things that they had for the dogs in New York is that this guy lost his dog. He was a caller on Off the Hook. He lost his dog, went down the pound to pick it up, and he says, "Is your dog?" "Is my dog?" And he says, "Well, he doesn't have an RFID tag." And he said, "Well, he's going to have an RFID tag before he leaves this place, or we're putting him to sleep."
Whoa.
Yeah.
He said RFID.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, basically, you paid $98 to put this, tag in there, and you should have the freedom to say you don't want it in there. And it's actually something Mayor Giuliani signed to do that. So,
if it's legislated, it shouldn't be, then the individual shouldn't have to pay for it.
That's another thing. I was like, if you have to, that can be debated. That doesn't mean it just because it's legislated. I forget who put all this legislation in for companies to provide all these different things. And I'm really summarizing the story. All these companies were to provide all these different things to be safety measures, stuff like that, for the employees and the business and yada, yada, yada. And then after he left office and he went to go start a company, he had to go through all these things, and he realized, how the hell are you going to start a company when you have to actually spend all this money up front and yada, yada, yada. So I don't think legislation, just because it's legislated, doesn't mean you have to...
It's corporate welfare, though.
Yeah,
I mean, that's
exactly
the bottom line, is they make something mandatory to achieve the economies of scale to reduce their manufacturing cost.
Yeah.
And it exploits the consumer.
So, actually this led on to something interesting. Go listen to Off the Hook on the October 1st, 2003 edition. They kind of raised the thing as, let's say if you buy, like, certain products or whatever, and you're wearing those RFID tags, they could tie the product, because they all have their own special serial number. Not just like, this shirt has this serial number, this can has a serial number. They all have their own serial numbers. You can actually tie the serial number to your credit card, which ties it to your name. And, you could use it for, you could use it for forensics, kind of, for
identification.
Identification. Install one at your
front
door.
Put it
in
the food, though. They're going to have RFID tags contained in food.
It's the size of rice. The thing is the size of a piece of rice.
Oh, great. I'm going to crack a tooth on it.
Already, Gillette has contracted to put these in razors, not in a pack of razors, but each individual razor.
Well, they can put it in the handle. Yeah.
I feel like I'm
so
doing...
So they know what time I'm shaving.
I feel like I'm doing the whole October 1st edition of Off Dark Show, but I'm going to mention one more thing. I didn't expect to do this, but they did talk about the... I mean, I read this also outside of the show and everything, but yeah, it's got more info. Is the Coca-Cola putting the GPS trackers in the winning Coke cans?
Ooh, that's kind of neat.
Yeah. So let's... And it's going to be mandated, too, that they're going to have that, like a GPS sort of tracking device in your cell phone, too.
Oh, that's, you know, I'm
another reason not to buy a cell phone.
So, I mean, that's, you know, it's just another reason to watch out and maybe stay away from consumer products like that. And, I don't know, there's benefits of using a cell phone. There's, I don't ever see anybody win any of those stupid sweepstakes. I don't know if that's really relevant, but...
My advice, shop at thrift stores and eat out of garbage cans.
There we go.
Well. Yeah.
Or start communes all across the country where you make all your own goods and grow your own food.
Yeah, make sure you say grow your own food.
Hey.
Qualify that, grow your own.
You want to bring up your trading cards?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Those things are really fun.
Plug those.
There's foundart.com and... I forget the ATC site, but it's there's this little trend that's underground art trading cards that they're called art trading cards, and you make little cards that are the size of like baseball cards or you know other trading cards that are 2.5 inches by 3.5 inches.
You make them yourself.
You make them yourself and you trade them, and there's several sites, several internet sites that like you can. That you can register with and send them like 10 of your trading cards and they'll send you 10 from random people all over the world. And so it's all free because you make something and you're trading it. And so you can have this whole, you know, rotating field of art around you that, you know, whenever you get tired of something, you can trade it away and, or make a new one and trade something else for it. And so it's really neat. There's several different styles. You know, you can do like paper stuff, materials, non-paper. And it's actually, I've been doing it for a little while. It's really fun.
Cool. Yeah, so that's, that's something you get involved in. That's enjoyable and it's artistic and it's kind of like Burning Man.
Yeah.
And actually, you should bring your cards to Burning Man.
Well, yeah, or you can... Yeah, contact me if you want to trade like non-paper cards. You know, I'm all about that.
VR, what's your email address?
Oh, I don't...
Do you have one now?
No, I haven't hooked up on... No.
Okay, you can email it now. Slipmode@quest.net, Q-W-E-S-T, and put in and out on the subject. All right. I've got more of a scientific story. I just like to discuss these things every once in a while as they come out. And basically, it's first light from one atom laser.
Ooh.
And that's what it sounds like, folks. Physicists in the U.S. built a laser with a single atom for the first time. Jeff Kimball and colleagues at the California Institute of Technology made the device by trapping a cold calcium atom in an optical cavity. The one-atom laser produces non-classical light that could be used with applications of quantum information technology, quantum encryption, and information technology. So it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, and that does have some implications of how small like lasers and how you know much they can be embedded in the future.
Yeah, you know, you can increasingly see VR.
Uh oh.
Yeah.
I didn't think it was time yet.
They're coming for you, dude.
No, it was supposed to be next week.
All right. The cat's out of the bag. VR is actually from planet... What's the planet you're from?
Xenon.
And
I've been doing...
Can you tell your friends to keep it down, VR? just a little bit.
All right. Yeah.
Okay.
There we go.
Wait. Well, I want him to talk to you again, but just, you know...
Well, they sent me about here about 20 years ago just to do research on the human organism. And
performance anxiety, I think.
Let me ask you this. Have you guys already invented this where you come from?
Oh, that's like vinyl.
Yeah, it's old school, right?
Real old school.
Like vinyl.
Yeah. All right.
I'm really going to miss all your colorful metaphors and euphemisms. And
me?
Yeah, well, they're going to take me away here pretty soon.
Oh, you know, I was talking to one of our listeners, and he loves hearing your, like, one-liners. Oh, he absolutely loves it. He's all, oh, VR, I love that guy. He's such a goofball. He's talking about the, not in all, in a good sense.
Yeah,
when you do your one, you know, your one-liners, or you're going off, and you're talking about the, you know, the ecology of the world together of the, you know what I mean? And
yeah, you just can't pull it off.
That's why you're on the show, and he loves to listen to it. He can't wait.
Right
to
on. So well, whoever that is, thank you very much.
It's Bweef.
Bweef.
Yeah, Bweef, which is sounds weird, but it's actually Norwegian. So that's how you explain it. That's how you say it, actually.
Yeah, because it kind of sounds like a vaginal discharge, but...
Ooh. That's queef, my friend.
Whoa. That's... Yeah, something like that.
Something's getting... All right, show's going in a... All right. That's why... See, Bob, that's why you don't eat Filibertos. That's why you don't eat Filibertos.
Whoa. Filibertos is the bomb.
Yeah. Filibertos, keeping in the now people going for hours and hours. All right. Another scientific article is another thing that's happening out there in the world. The first phase of an ambitious computing network designed to handle huge amounts of data has been launched. The network dubbed the Grid has been set up by the CERN labs in Geneva to tap into processing power of computers in 12 countries. The aim of the project is to handle data from an experiment on how the universe began. CERN believes the Grid could eventually provide access to a vast pool of processing power for their desktops. From their desktops. The idea behind Grid technology is to link up computers around the world over the internet to create a new generation of enormously powerful machines. The networks are needed because some problems in science are just too large for any one machine to tackle by itself. CERN's Grid will initially be used to handle the terabytes of data generated by an upcoming particle accelerator called the Larne-Hardin Collider. And they'll be using that to process the data and store it. So,
Years ago, SETI did something very similar to that for home computers. You downloaded a screensaver, and whenever the screensaver came up, it would process some of the SETI's information for them.
Yeah, there's a lot of things like out there like that. There's Beowulf, and I mean, there's been cluster computing, and people have done cluster computing with the PlayStation 2s. Now they're doing with the G5 Macintoshes, and it's out there. But they're using in this instance to produce results from atom collider.
Yeah, the squash of atoms.
So,
now what's doing with the G5?
What do you mean? Oh, it's Apple's 64-bit processor.
Yeah.
It's their new architecture.
Well, I know, but what are they doing with the...
Oh, they took 1,100 of them.
Uh-huh.
Weren't we on a show where you talked about that with me?
No.
I mean, I talked about it with you, maybe. Yeah, they took 1,100 of them, and they're chaining them together at Virginia Tech and make a supercomputer out of them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That'd be a massive it'd be a super, super computer.
Yeah, super duper.
That's right.
Apple computer.
I think that was applause.
Yeah, it was pretty darn close. But it was applause of one hand clapping.
I'm the only Mac person here.
I mentioned on one of the previous shows, the last show, that we were toying with the idea of going portable with the show. And just bringing all my equipment to a place and seeing if other people would like to get involved. I haven't had a chance to test that, but I think we're still going to work on it and put it together, and maybe in the next show or the show following that. But I think very soon we're going to try to take it on the road and maybe hang out at this one coffee house I know about. They usually have bands there that people go to listen to. But maybe we can pull off a show, and people would enjoy listening in the audience, and maybe submitting some feedback or any other information.
Yeah, or I'd would it be really fun is like reenacting the last few minutes of Pump Up the Volume, the movie, where they're driving around doing the radio show from the Jeep as the FCC is tracking them down.
Yeah, I could do it in my Honda, and you know, we'll do in and out at 100 miles an hour down the
right on
down the road.
Yeah, have the helicopter.
Get the helicopter on your ass.
Yeah.
Actually, they're looking for your friends, Leo.
Oh, okay.
But thank goodness they're cloaked.
That's right.
And they're waiting to pick you up to take you to Jack in the Box, right? You guys are going to get some goodies?
Oh, yeah, because we don't have Jack in the Box. So the Jumbo Jack is a universal phenomenon.
And they accept Visa and MasterCard there now, which, of course, they take anywhere in the universe.
That's right, because they're everywhere you want to be.
Yeah. But they don't sell a Moby and
Oh, man. Yeah.
Yeah, no Pepto.
Oh, wow. Man, what a segue. What a segue.
Segue.
Virus knocked out State Department Visa checking system.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Man. So
props,
you guys
flip there.
Might be screwed if you go. Basically, the State Department's electronic system for checking every Visa applicant. Oh, well, no. Not, well, it's kind of a segue. We're talking about visas.
Yeah, but it's still Visa.
All right, it's Visa, yeah. Visa applicant for terrorism, for terrorists or criminal history failed worldwide late Tuesday, which is September 23rd, I believe, because of the computer virus leaving the U.S. government unable to issue visas. It was unclear which computer virus might have affected the system, but a separate message sent to the embassies and consular offices late Tuesday warned that the Welchia virus had been detected in one facility. Welchia is an aggressive infection unleashed last month that exploits a new software flaw in recent versions of Microsoft Windows. So, man, you know, that's just another person that's been taken out by these new recent exploits or viruses that have been released in the wild from Microsoft. So, as we said in the past, it's very important to patch. And, you know what, put a... You know, it's really easy to figure out. You know, they spend all this money on security and stuff for these systems. Hopefully, they're spending it on these systems. And it's really easy to figure out. Don't use Outlook and put a huge frickin' firewall in front of your Windows network, and that'll help you at least a little bit. And that's a pretty elementary idea there. I mean, just do that. You know, and you're gonna block a lot to begin with. So, not everything.
Yeah, because otherwise, a lot of the other monies that are spent on security are worthless.
Don't use any bundled software from Microsoft. Period.
But then include Windows.
There's otherwise no reason to use Outlook.
Well, yeah. Lotus Notes is a good replacement for Outlook. So is Linux with Evolution.
Or Eudora.
Or anything, actually.
Or fine. Paper.
But... yeah. How about mail?
Paper works really well.
Remember? Less? Yeah, less. Yeah.
There we go.
You can just let...
Cat.
Yeah, just
how
cat...
How school is that?
Just cat var mail username. There you go.
Appropriate technology. Back the UI.
Yeah. All right. Also, things happening out there on the internet. VeriSign thought it would be very... smart of them to basically put wildcards in their domain name queries. If you misspell a possible, misspell a domain name or put a domain name in that doesn't actually exist, you will...
Those weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah, you are a terrorist, me. you may be redirected to VeriSign's site, which I believe that they're like, hey, you know, you can buy this domain if you want to. It's available. But the ICANN basically said that's a violation of DNS rules and that they need to fix that and get rid of it and reverse their changes back to the way it was. So that's a bunch of crap. I mean, come on. I don't know. How can they think that they could get away from it? I mean, that would be unfair competition for other registrars.
Yeah, but when you have a pseudo-competitive system, you have to do what you got to do to maintain your monopoly.
Yeah. I thought that is advertising, but that's just... Oh, gosh.
I mean,
how about the national do not pop-up list? How about that? You know?
Give out your IP.
Yeah.
Well, don't send pop-ups to this IP.
Yeah. Just send in whole ranges.
Well, there are those, you know, pop-up stopper
star
programs.
Dot star dot star.
Yeah.
Well, there are those programs that stop most of the pop-ups.
Yeah, yeah. And the newer versions of Mozilla's browser, they have something like that built in, so it's pretty nice.
Also, very good reason to have a marginal operating system that nobody else uses.
Oh, your pop-ups don't come up on them?
Yeah, I use Safari, and I don't have the problems that I would if I was using IE.
Wow.
Yeah, pretty much everything is made for IE. You know, it's developed for IE first, and then they try to see if they can, you know, do a broad one for everything, yeah. So, man, that's...
So it'll get to you eventually.
Yeah, eventually, and then it'll be time to move on.
Yeah. So thank goodness for alternatives, huh? I mean...
different is good.
Different or, you know, alternatives or whatever. That's... Everything's...
And it keeps...
Choice.
Yeah, and it keeps the, you know, new challenge for programmers, too.
All right. Well, this is something for you file swappers, music listeners, and stuff like that out there that want to be able to continue to share your files to whatever device or wherever you may want to carry it. Intel and Sony and a host of other Japanese electronics manufacturers basically developed something called the Digital Transmission Content Protection over IP Protocol Specification. It's basically embodied in home networks and would permit consumers to play download music or movies on a PC or any PC or digital device in the home. However, the download material can't be transmitted outside the home or copied.
Just when you got all this neat hardware that works together, now it doesn't no more.
Yeah. I don't know, you know. I honestly don't care, you know. It's...
There's going to be something that you can that somebody's going to figure out how to a loophole in that.
Oh yeah.
Well, it's natural selection. I mean, you know, all the normal people won't be able to do anything. Smart people will. So it's Darwinism in action.
Well, they might have a smart person make something and spread it to all the other people. And
it'll be a good meme.
Whoa! Was that a plug for me?
Oh no! Actually, there's a book, I forget what it was called now, but it actually talked about memes as mm-hmm. ideas that are transferred from one person to another, and the evolution and the fitness of ideas is what actually becomes the hegemony of society.
See, that's what I was thinking about. Thought language.
Contagion.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's what I was thinking about language, because, you know, there's a lot of simple words that sound the same in almost, a wide variety of languages.
Mm-hmm.
And you're wondering if, I think you could possibly use that to figure out when each person or culture met the other culture.
Actually, they have done that.
Yeah. I'm sure they have.
And especially in Americas where it's really easy. They've actually can trace back several, I think they got to several different crossings across the sea from Russia to Alaska.
Yeah, like basic communication that you'd need to carry along with, another person. I think that some of those words were expressed to other people, and they're like, this is how I say it, and I'm like, okay. And then they may put their accent on it, which means that's why they spelled a little bit different. It's how they interpreted the word. And then you'll find other words that sound nothing like one another, because at that point in time, with that communication between the two cultures, they didn't need to use those other words. Mm-hmm. And they, already developed, their own dialect to explain those words and stuff like that. So,
well, ideas and fads, just like animals, mutate and modify.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and then there's, late pigeon languages, which are where actually a couple of languages have become hybrids. That really very little has been lost from each one. They've really combined it into two, and so they can have five words that sound completely different that mean the same thing.
What about macro languages, though? The fact that when we make references to things, we don't have to have the taxonomy to specifically, granularly describe something. We say, oh, like the so-and-so in this movie, or like this song, and we have free association. We both know what we're talking about, even though we haven't really detailed what we're talking about.
Right, it just becomes an overall labeling and, mm-hmm. and a reference to another kind of culture. But also what's really neat and how pigeon languages work is like the first generation figures out what all the words mean, and then the next generation usually figures out a syntax for them and what the proper grammar is. And they just make it up. The kids, you know...
Or had a job with it.
Yeah,
but now we're jacking the language, though. Look at how words get appropriated, you know, from one culture to another, because, you know, the youth culture will frequently take something that the establishment has created and you know, basically morph it into a completely different meaning. So we, in a sense, emasculate the control that these things have over us, you know, with respect to brands and things like that.
Well, at the same time, is a lot of those things that we're able to, you know, to glean from other, from somewhere else, is they're not normally part of our written language or anything. It's, I'm starting to think about when something becomes written, it becomes almost written in stone in our mind and how
well, it's through the usage that it actually proliferates. Mm-hmm. So that's why a lot of, like, commonly held beliefs or popular opinions are largely mistaken, is if you repeat something out of context and another person hears it, it could be 20 steps removed by the time it proliferates.
Oh, yeah, because then it just becomes this free-flowing. It's a meme that whether or not it's true.
What the heck is a slip? A Freudian slip. Oh, yeah. I found a slip.
You found a slip?
Yeah. Are you lost? You're finding memes.
Cross-dressing for psychiatrists.
I'm finding slips.
You're finding slips. All right. I got it now.
You almost did.
That took me a little bit there.
I
was off in VR land there.
I know. Yeah. So, all right. Well, jumping around as we usually tend to do, we're starting to see the emergence of the 64-bit processor into the home market. There have already been 64-bit processors out, but typically they were used for high-end business applications. Now you're starting to finally see it coming to the home with the introduction of the G5. And now on the Intel, I guess you could say Intel, how about this PC hardware? You'll start to find that AMD actually released their Athlon 64-bit processor. It's in 2 GHz and 2.2 GHz models, from what I've seen. Of course, it's backwards compatible, so you can use your 32-bit applications because there is no 64-bit applications. There is a 64-bit Windows. I know that they're releasing to work with this and other, you know, when Intel comes out with their Pentium 5. But it's starting to come out. Here's some things I read about, which are kind of interesting. It's something that says Pentium 5 will launch with 64-bit Windows Elements, which is kind of like their software to allow it to be 64-bit, basically 64-bit extensions. The Pentium 5 is likely to fly along at between 5 GHz and 7 GHz with 2 MB plus of Level 2 cache. Be built on a 90-nanometer process and have a stackable design. Now, this is the interesting thing. The processor, we believe, sits in the LGA 775-pin socket, and above it is a very thin heatsink. But according to sources close to the firm's plans, another permeable heatsink can sit between this and another microprocessor module, giving it a stackable design. The final design of this arrangement has not yet been set in stone. According to the source, and the details have not been confirmed, a module sitting on top could provide 64-bit extensions. And the source claimed Microsoft is ready to launch a version of Windows called Elements with 64-bit extensions. The idea seems that people can buy a 32-bit module and then add in a 64-bit processor. So, for the upgradeness of moving to 64.
Upper compatibility.
Yeah, moving to 64. So, pretty interesting. All right. Well, we are going to get into our Linux section, I guess you could say. A little bit of SCO news, and we will be going into the explanation of the GPL. That's right. We want to set it straight here, and we'll go through and talk about what the GPL is and what it isn't. Okay. Here is a little bit of SCO news. It's getting really soft now because all the everything that's coming out is getting, you know,
saturated
and discredited, and people are running out of crap. Well, SCO is. Let's put it that way. Let's make it sound correct. HP to indemnify customers from Linux legal claims. Basically, HP will. You get attacked by SCO for running Linux. They will fight the court case for you. We'll provide full identity across the entire suite of store-related action, says Mark Fink, HP's vice president of Linux. If customers were to get sued by SCO, we would take off their take over their defense and assume liability on their behalf. The indemnification program is limited to customers who receive a Linux distribution from HP, run it on HP hardware, and have a contract with HP. There's no additional charge for the protection. Fink said HP is not paying any Linux-related licensing fees to SCO. So, you know, they're going to... I mean, that sounds cool. I don't think people...
You have to be completely HP to do it.
Well, yeah. You know, I'm going to... Let me actually... expand on this. SCO is going on this road show. Basically, they're touting their crap to everyone they can. Kind of sounds like a run for Congress or presidency
or
government. Yeah. And so they're doing their road trip, and their premier sponsor is Hewlett Packard. Their premier sponsor is Hewlett Packard. So, you know, the article said something to the effect of... what the hell are they doing? They're going to protect Linux users, but they're also sponsoring SCO's roadshow. You know, I don't know what to think of that.
Well, it's called disjointed PR. They're also recycling computer cases.
Well, yeah. I mean, I can see that there's something there, but I don't know. It's
or it's a nifty little move on the part of HP that they don't lose any consumers, that they're protecting their hardcore consumers, and they look good about it. And if, you know, SCO actually goes after them because they've assumed all responsibility and liability, that they go, hey, you really want to go after us? We won't sponsor you anymore. And SCO goes, oh, sorry.
Or maybe it is, you know, strategic as opposed to tactical then.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the first thing I thought of. But I don't know. It's just a... crappy mess.
We'll definitely see in the end.
And then along those lines of SCO, basically SCO announced a while back that they were going to revoke SGI's license to Unix. What?
It's just been so long.
Oh.
I mean, you know, it's kind of like too late, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah, so they said that they were going to do that, and they said that, you know, if you remove the code, I don't know, they said they were kind of saying, SCO meaning, was saying, you know, SGI, if you start removing our code, you know, then we might let it go on you, but then, you know, we may not. Anyways.
But have they even announced what the code is?
No. Anyways, SGI basically did a letter to the Linux community basically saying that they support Linux, they love Linux, and they did go through and try to find any SCO-related code and remove it and rewrite code. And they said they did that. And they said that there are some areas to where they still need to rewrite the code, but they've identified it and they're going to remove it. And yada, yada, yada. So they're doing that, and they're saying, you know, we're taking the steps that we need to take to de-SCO-ify, I guess, or maybe de-BSD or de... you know, Unix is 5, you know, I mean, who knows where the damn code came from? Like we've talked about before, that, you know, some of the code, they don't really know if it's actually originating from SCO. You know, it could have came from somebody else, went into the SCO code, and I mean, it's open code, so they still don't even know that. But they're trying to take to what they think they know is and remove it. So it's a nice letter to the open source community. And of course, they're trying to get SCO off their back if they're, you know, going to be attacked by SCO. And, so, I mean, basically it's just going to come down to the fact that they released all this code with their SCO Linux distribution under the GPL. And I think that'll probably be the largest argument, is that despite whatever they prove who has what code, and despite how it got there, the fact that they redistributed it on their own behalf under the GPL is probably going to fall into question. And they had said once that copyright... is takes more effect than what the GPL license is, saying like, well, we did have a copyright and we did release it under GPL, but since we had a copyrighted, you know, it takes precedence, and Not really, because I mean the GPL clearly states that this code's open. And once you do that, you've now taken a copyright code and brought it into the public domain.
So yeah, I think once that's done, that should, once it opens up,
that's it.
So, because it's so hard to like undo that sort of thing.
Well, it's almost like they're trying to give intellectual property a bad name or something. I mean, it doesn't make sense because you're going to put people into stagflation where they're going to be afraid to do anything if there's some risk that some little legacy piece of something has something in it, you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, eventually, if you want to get that far in, is if you use, like, two words together, that somebody could have that copyrighted. Or, you know, two characters
well,
and whatnot.
Well, this is the thing, you know, genetics and informatics, for instance, you got companies like P.E. Solera who mapped the human genome, and they actually patented genes. Not a process, not a technology, but a discovery.
Oh, wow.
I mean, that's a very scary precedent when companies are, you know,
yeah, patenting
it's proprietary when it's a discovery.
Yeah.
Imagine if someone had patented electricity.
Well, have you ever heard of, you ever heard of Nikola Tesla?
Oh yeah, there you go.
Yeah, he got totally screwed, you know, by what's his name?
Well, his whole idea was
Edison.
Yeah, his whole idea was to give free electricity to everybody.
Yeah, I mean, it was the contest of
who could electrocute somebody the best is actually what really got Tesla bad.
Yeah.
Is that AC, you know, in the DC. Yeah, that the DC actually left the person twitching after they electrocuted with him, and AC didn't. And so, wow, it was more humane to kill somebody with AC than DC. So let's use that one.
Huh.
It was a,
what happened to a good old-fashioned hanging?
Yeah,
you know, I'd rather...
Yeah.
Actually, in New Jersey, I think you have that option.
I'd rather take, like, you know, whatever pill or gas or something than being,
yeah, rather
than being electrocuted. Come on, their eyes, you know, come out of their face. You got to tape them in, you know. Jeez.
Sometimes they have to refry them, too.
Yeah, they're like, I think he's still going. He's like...
Still on fire.
Moving his fingers still. Help! Yeah, zap him again, John. No.
Damn conservation.
Yeah, but it was. I think it was Carnegie that was sponsoring Tesla there for a while, and he wanted to power the entire world with like static electricity. But then in the middle of the construction,
they'd be like the Living Under the Power Lines kids, though.
Yeah, we would all have. There would only be one hairstyle, and it would be spiky. Yeah, but halfway through the construction of his massive Tesla coil. You know,
so Einstein was a beta tester.
Yeah, pretty much. And, you know, the Carnegie went, oh, wait, how's everybody going to pay for that if it's free in the air? Oh, I'm pulling funding.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, I guess, you know, you do have to come to the conclusion that you do need commerce to make the world go round. Just finding the delicate balance of where things should have commerce and where things should be free.
But don't forget now, you know, nuclear energy was billed as electricity too cheap to meter.
Oh, yeah. And yet we still pay the same amount, if not more, for it in the long run because of the storage fees of waste that will, yeah, that our waste now will last far beyond anything we've ever made before.
It's kind of like they had the reverse Moore's law on everything but microchips. You know, it's like everything gets more expensive no matter what.
Yeah.
That's a you know that's what's funny with that'd be funny if when you got electric they only could use so much juice, and then if they had to use more they'd bill the family you know of the guy saying look we had to zap him three times you owe us $500 you know, you know like when you go and get an ambulance you got to pay $500 for the damn thing to
hey,
pick you up.
He took more amps than the other guy, so you got to pay.
Yeah, this guy was cheap.
They'll do it by body weight, you know.
Oh yeah, how you know how much is it? Has it take to cook a 5-pound turkey rather than 25-pound one.
The
are they going to charge you for your torture? Because you know, if they use a train set or something, you know, that's
a train
too.
Set. Up the ampers on that, buddy. What is it? The it's interesting. I found out that the price of gas back in the 50s is with added inflation is the same price we pay for gas now.
I think it's. No, well, it's pretty darn close. And the same with the barrels of oil that were about $40 a barrel when it was first found, and It's about the same.
Yeah, but you know, the United States has been paying less for gas than everybody. When I was in the Netherlands, it was like $4 a gallon.
Oh, yeah.
England, they pay a lot for gas, too.
Well, so does Canada and Mexico. They pay much more than we do. They go by the liter.
That's because we consume more. So we get a deal.
That's because all the oil-producing countries don't want to, like, you know, they want to give us at a good rate. Otherwise, we go in there and bomb them.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they do have a lot of aging infrastructure, and they got to offload those capital assets on the consumers because they don't want to lose money when the new energy rolls around.
That's right. I'm still praying for hydrogen. That'll be fun.
Cold fusion.
They won't bring it out until they can screw it up somehow.
Yeah. Well, until there's almost no, you know, fossil fuels left.
Yeah.
That's when it'll be a necessity.
Well, we have officially reached peak oil production this year. I read a white paper on it. So, in other words, we are at the maximum point in the bell curve, and it's downhill from here while the population's going up.
Enjoy. So we'll just be using more and more because there's going to be more and more SUVs on the road. So it's going to be very downward, very steep slope on that.
We consume 80% of the resources, and now the rest of the world wants to drive. Imagine that.
Oh, I know. That's
all right. Well, let's see. I'm glad Bob stayed awake long enough to finally get to the section that he's interested
in
the most.
So.
Well, no, we did this go. We're going to talk about the GPL now.
Let's go.
Oh, let's go. Okay, that's right. Okay. Now this is this is going to be important. So what we're going to do is we're going to focus and we're going to not do the sound effects on this one, or things like that, and talk about what the GPL really is. And what I'm going to do is basically. Just read this article from Buif, which is, he's from Norway, and people have heard him on RFA. Well, they had, he sent out a letter, they mentioned his name, he had a letter into RFA, and he's a friend of mine. Actually, you know, I wanted to have him on the show, but I just don't have good enough equipment to pull his voice in. It's really cheap for me to call Norway for some reason. All right, so I had him craft up his thoughts on the GPL. And he's, you know, really into it as well as I am. And plus, I had, you know, ran into some people that keep talking about Linux, and they just don't seem to understand what it is. So I just wanted to cover what the GPL is once and for all, and expel anything that it may not be, and describe what it is. Okay, here's his letter. Dear sir, I heard that your next show will have the GPL as its main topic. I want to explain why there is a need for a license such as the GPL. The GPL's purpose is to protect the freedoms that comes with the free software. To understand that, one must first understand what free software is and what the opposite is. Proprietary software is program code that is not free or semi-free. Its use, redistribution, and modification is prohibited or requires you to ask for permission or is restricted so much that you can't do it freely. Semi-free software is software that is not free, but comes with permission from individuals to use, copy, distribute, and modify it for non-profit purposes. The term freeware has no accepted definition, but it is most commonly used for packages which permit redistribution, but not modification, and their source code is not available. These packages are not free software, so don't use freeware software to refer to free software. Shareware is software which comes with permission for people to redistribute copies, but says that anyone who continues to use a copy is required to pay a license fee. Commercial software is software being developed by a business which aims to make money from a use of the software. Commercial and proprietary software are not the same thing. Most commercial software is proprietary, but there is commercial free software, and there's non-commercial non-free software. So what must be the truth about a particular software program for it to be considered free software? Free software, in quotes, is a matter of liberty, not price. To understand the concept, you should think of free as in free speech, not as in free beer. Free software is a matter of users' freedom to run, copy, distribute, study, change, and improve the software more precisely. It refers to four kinds of freedom for the users of the software. The freedom to run the program for any purpose, the freedom to study how the program works and adapt it to your needs, access to the source code is a precondition for this. The freedom to redistribute copies so you can help your neighbor. The freedom to improve the program and release your improvements to the public so that the whole community benefits. Access to the source code is also a precondition for this. The program is free software if the users have all these freedoms. Thus, you should be free to redistribute copies either with or without modifications, either gratis or charging a fee for distribution to anyone anywhere. Being free to these things means, among other things, that you do not have to ask or pay for permission. In order for the freedoms to make changes and to publish improved versions to be meaningful, you must have access to the source code of the program. Therefore, accessing of source code is necessary condition for free software. In order for these freedoms to be real, they must provide an irrevocable as long as you do nothing wrong. If the developer of the software has the power to revoke the license without your doing anything to give cause, the software is not free. However, certain kinds of rules about the manner of distributing free software are acceptable when they don't conflict with the general freedoms. For example, copy left, which is not copyright, copy left, very simply stated, is the rule that when redistributing the program, you cannot add restrictions to deny other people the central freedoms. This rule does not conflict with the central freedoms, rather it protects them. Thus, you may have paid money to get copies of the free software, or you may have obtained copies at no charge, but regardless of how you got the copies, you always have the freedom to copy and change the software, even to sell the copies. Free software does not mean non-commercial. A free program must be available for commercial use, commercial development, and commercial distribution. Commercial development of free software is no longer unusual. Such free commercial software is very important. One can use copy left to protect these freedoms legally for everyone. Copy left is a general method for making a program free software and requiring all modified and extended versions of the program to be free software as well. The simplest way to make a program free is to put it in the public domain uncopyrighted. This allows people to share the program and their improvements if they are so minded. But it also allows uncooperating people to convert the program into proprietary software. They can make changes, many or few, and distribute the result as proprietary product. People who receive the program in that modified form do not have the freedom that the original author gave them. The middleman has stripped it away. The aim of copy left, the GPL, is to give all users the freedom to redistribute and change software. If the middleman could strip off the freedom, we might have many users. But those users would not have freedom. So instead of putting the software in the public domain, it gets copy lefted. Copy left says that anyone who redistributes the software, with or without changes, must pass along the freedom to further copy and change it. Copyleft guarantees that every user has freedom. Copyleft also provides an incentive for other programmers to add to free software. Important free programs such as GNU C++ compiler exist only because of this. Copyleft also helps programmers who want to contribute improvements to the free software get permission to do that. These programmers often work with companies or for companies or universities that would do almost anything to get more money. A programmer may want to contribute her changes to the community, but her employer may want to turn the changes into a proprietary software product. When the employer is explained that it is illegal to distribute the improved version except as free software, the employer usually decides to release it as free software rather than throw it away. To copy left a program, one first state that it is copyrighted, and then add distribution terms, which are legal instruments that give everyone the rights to use, modify, and redistribute the program's code or any program derived from it, but only if the distribution terms are unchanged. Thus, the code and the freedoms become legally inseparable. Proprietary software developers use copyright to take away from the user's freedom. The GPL is a guarantee of their freedom. That's why the name change, copyright to copy left. So clearly there's a need for the GPL. And then Bui says, thank you for your time and your service. And his sources are GNU.org.
Right on, Bui.
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 It's like beef with a W. Bui.
Bui. Right.
And the only way I was able to figure that out was actually by talking to him on the phone. But yeah, that's pretty much it right there. That describes the limitations and the benefits of it, and how it's created a model for development, evolution, and freedom to not be tied into all these nasty things we've talked about here on the show.
Yeah, I really enjoyed how well that was broken down. I've never seen anything.
Yeah, it's very comprehensive. The problem is somebody has like one piece of vocabulary and they use it inappropriately and then it takes on a life of its own. Then no two people are talking about the same thing because they mean apples when they're saying oranges and there's no communication.
That's right.
Well, see, you know, one thing that stemmed my wanting to talk about this, and I don't know if he's going to make this text available somewhere. You know, I basically, you know, I mean, knew that from reading it, but I knew that he had a very good understanding of it, and I think he could have put it in really good words, which is what he did, and that's why I read it. And if he posted somewhere, maybe I'll put a post in the forums about it on slipknot.org, so you can reread it. But the thing that brought this up for me to want to talk about, I had somebody in one of my classes that kept telling me that Linux needs to be more competitive with, you know, business applications like Microsoft and stuff like that. And I said, well, I said, you know, they're doing what they can. I mean, they've got Office software and stuff like that. But he's like, yeah, but they really need to get in there and, like, produce more apps and do all that. And he was coming from the effect that, you know, Linux has to do this. And I was like, you know, in all essence, they don't really have to do anything. And, you know, I was like, it pretty much works like this. You know, someone said we're sick of all these other proprietary things and we want to develop this free and open system to be able to adapt and learn from and modify and change and evolve. And then it comes to a thing where they're like, man, you know, I wish I had some sort of financial software other than on Windows because I have to install Windows and I got to put on QuickBooks and I don't want to use this crap. And then, you know, the guy ends up saying, well, I'm just going to go write my own piece of software that does that. And that's exactly what the program Raysound's about. I've talked with the programmer there, and I use it for the show. And he said he didn't find a good audio editor in Linux, and he just decided to write one. So it's not a matter of people saying, like, oh, we want to directly compete. Maybe companies like IBM and Red Hat and stuff like that, you know, they have their business interests to compete. But the general programmer for open source typically is just, they're like, cool, I want to figure out if I can make this work, or, like, it'd be nice to have this feature, or, you know, man, I want an alternative to this piece of software. It's not like it's in every programmer's mind to be like, well, what does Microsoft have? You know, I need to make something that's competitive with that. They don't really care if it's competitive or not because they're going to develop it in their own liking, and which really is separate of anybody else's software. I may develop something that's different from somebody else, and I should develop from a standpoint to where I think things make sense. Of course, you know, you need to take contributions from others and take ideas from others and put it together. It's not. I don't really think it's that's what it's about. It's about.
Well, there's really neat vocabulary change there with like that he was saying that they need to be more competitive. When open source stuff is more about what do I need, what do I want,
yeah,
and what will benefit the, you know, whenever I put it out, it benefits the community. And, you know, Microsoft is what they want, when open source is more is what do I need.
Well, it begs the question about, in my opinion, misplaced loyalties. Because think about it. This is a consumer lamenting that he's got choice.
Yeah. That it's not that personal responsibility.
I mean, I've
there.
Had people diss me, you know, because of my platform. It's like, hey, why are you using Windows? And I'm like, well, what should it matter, you know, because I use formats that are, you know, universal export formats, so what skin is it off your back if I'm using, you know, Mac OS or using, you know, IRIX or some other platform? It's like there's this conformist mentality on the part of casual computer users to poo-poo serious users who have unique, sophisticated needs. But somehow, we almost think we gotta have one dominant standard, you know, like Betamax versus VHS, and they think everything's like that.
Yeah. When that's
whereas
when
the internet, you know, makes that an anachronism that you have to all be in the same platform. You know, that's the whole point is to have, you know, open platforms that communicate seamlessly, and there are people who don't like that.
Well, there are some there's some advantages to not having, you know, a complete universal platform, is because we
the choice.
Well, and also like viruses and problems can travel incredibly quickly. But yeah. Say at the same thing is that's the benefit as well, because information can travel incredibly quickly.
Well, I mean, we have proprietary systems, you know, and we have a lot of things that are not meant for public mass consumption. You know, when people have very sophisticated needs, you know, you have vertical markets that provide, you know, mission critical applications, you know, that are not, you know, something just anybody can screw around with.
Right, and that's not really something that's an open source issue.
No.
Unless you want to do it, you're absolutely
tough. But I think that's
tough.
The thing, though, is I think when you say software to one person, it means one thing, mm-hmm. but to Joe Schmo consumer, it means shrink-wrapped.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's the problem, is shrink-wrapped software to the average Joe Schmo on the street just means everything, and they don't understand that people want to make their own stuff or modify it. Or
they need to modify it. They need that versatility and that choice.
You know, the one thing that I think a lot of Microsoft users don't understand is that the people that particularly use Linux or even BSD or an alternative don't really give a crap about what's going on in the Windows community.
And they're not plug-and-play people. They enjoy figuring things out.
Yeah. You know, so it's like it's these, you know, a lot of Microsoft people, they're trying to, in their mind, they want to adapt Linux to what they understand Microsoft to be, but have it free and open source.
It's a completely different culture.
Yeah, it's totally different. And that's the thing I was trying to explain to this person. I was like, look, it's not like that. And he was like getting argumentative with me. And like, you know, continually like talk to me. I was like, look, these guys just program because they want to, man. You know, I was like, they don't program for Bill, you know, to fight him. You know, they don't. And he's like, well, there's people that have business interests. So I was like, yeah, those are people called IBM and, you know, Red Hat, stuff like that. Those guys are businessmen. They're not open source developers. They're using open source as a business, you know, for money. But I mean, still, the availability of being open source, you could say, like, look, maybe Red Hat goes off in this extreme direction and, you know, you don't like their business model. Well, it doesn't mean there's not, you know, 20 other different type of distributions out there developing, you know, the same things but doing it over a different model. I mean, it's, you have the ability of the choice and the ability of the freedom, and that's what it's about. You know, you don't need this unified desktop interface. You know, Linux has got to build the desktop. They got to build the desktop. You know, I like the fact that they've got 20 different desktop interfaces. You know what I mean? You can pick and choose what you
matter.
Want.
See, the funny thing is where we need compatibility is file, you know, protocols and things like that. But as far as, like, your unique flavor that addresses your personal needs, why is that even an issue? And yet these people have this scorched earth policy. Like, I see morons out there using something like PowerPoint to do drawing and stuff, and then they're criticizing me using Adobe Illustrator, and I'm like...
Yeah, laying out in PowerPoint really sucks compared to, like, Illustrator.
But do you see what I'm saying, though, is they have this myopia where something fits their needs, and they think everyone's like them, and the funny thing is they're a casual user. They don't understand that DJs have different kind of software versus somebody who just wants to, you know, rip some music, you know, for their
MP3
player.
You're finding a lot of people plugging devices into Apple laptops and using that as their band.
Yeah.
You know? That's what the GPL is. You know what I'm going to do? I am going to somehow find a way to put this article or this letter from Weef and have it on maybe Slipnet or something like that. I mean, I have the text, so I'll put it in the forums, a link to it, so anybody can take a look at it.
We need a periodical chart of software, you know, like how they have the periodical guide to the elements, you know, where they're classified taxonomically, because maybe some people aren't aware of what is what. You know,
yeah, but still most people don't know what the periodic table, how to use it anymore anyway.
Yeah, that's true, too.
Because, oh, wait, I have to look at a chart.
But
yeah,
like, don't you think it seems like it's cool to, like, let's just say have one, like, the periodic table, like, put it on your wall.
Oh, that would be cool.
And you've got no freaking idea what it means. I'm talking about, like, the layman. They've got no freaking idea what it means, but they put it up there because they're cool.
Because it looks cool. And it's got pretty colors.
Like, yeah, I know what that is. I remember number 55 is, you know. But,
It'd be like a family tree of software, though. Like, what came from what? Scope probably wouldn't like that, though.
Yeah. So, yeah. I don't know if anybody else has anything else to say.
Yeah, I'm cool.
All right. Well, I hope, you know, again, we always talk about, like, so many different things. I always feel nervous, too, that I'm like, man, you know, we're jumping from, you know, from subject to subject. But I usually go back and listen to the shows. After I do every show, I listen to it again. And I think, you know, I'm able to follow it there. So I get a little nervous during the show, but it seems to come out all right.
Oh, and a public service announcement. Don't put a portable hard drive in your checked baggage.
Oh.
Will destroy it.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, you know what? Let's do that. I'd like you to tell everyone about your experience, Meme.
Yeah, I've had, you know, some relatively decent experiences, you know, as far as riding and not having my property confiscated or destroyed or impounded or getting arrested. So I got a little loosey-goosey, and I put a portable hard drive in a checked bag after it had already been inspected. And when I got home and I opened up my suitcase, there was a circuit board, front fascia, some loose screws, and a case floating around in my suitcase, all dismembered, taken apart, and they literally manhandled my drive, and then we wrote them the complaint, and they sent us a stupid form letter.
Wait, so you checked it. It went through the X-ray machine underneath.
Yeah, in other words, we went through the full inspection protocol, you know, where they X-ray it, and then they hand-inspect the bag, and they clear it and allow you to relock your bag before they check it.
And this isn't carry-on, right? This is under the plane.
Yeah, this is a checked bag.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, so they
passed inspection, you know, and they said, you know, your bag is clear, and they checked it.
Well, it would have to be after that checking process when they disassembled it.
That's what I'm saying, and they literally manhandled the drive. I mean, it was busted open.
Yeah, so she checked the bag, they looked through it, and then they started breaking this thing, this hard drive into pieces to figure out what's inside of it.
Well, when you checked it, what do you mean that they actually inspected it?
Okay, what I mean is the standard protocol is you go through the X-ray security. That's the first layer of security. The second layer of security...
But you check it at the booth before you even hit the X-rays.
That's what I'm saying. You go through multiple stages of inspections. But the final inspection before a bag is checked, you know, at the counter where they put it on a conveyor belt, TSA opens that suitcase up and inspects it.
Yeah.
And then they put a plastic sticker over the hinge so that if somebody were to open the case again, you know, the chain of evidence is broken.
Yeah.
Well, they cleared it. In other words, they said, you know, you can lock your bag back up. So it's going on the plane after that. Well, when I get back home, I open up my bag, and the hard drive is literally in pieces, and some of the screws were even missing.
Okay, so it happened, well, all that checking and opening and inspecting.
Somewhere
That happened under your, you could see that happening.
Well, the bottom line is it had to happen somewhere between Hawaii and Arizona.
Okay.
Yeah, this is behind the scenes. They check it, and you're not standing next to it.
Yeah, there's all airports have the X-ray machine, and that's underneath the airport.
But here's the thing, you know, the conventional wisdom of the Yahoo on the street would be, well, maybe they thought it was hazardous materials. Well, my question is, if you had something that was hazardous materials, would you take a hammer to it, or would you open it without proper grounding?
Yeah,
I don't think so.
No, that's pretty asinine.
And if they thought those agricultural contraband, like if a dog went crazy or something, put it in the X-ray machine. I mean, a hard drive looks like a hard drive in an X-ray machine. I know I shoulder surfed a few times on that.
Yeah, it's a spindle and the discs and everything.
Really obvious looking.
Yeah, that's...
And you did something in response.
Yeah, we wrote a letter, and they send you a very thoughtful form letter. In fact, the same form letter for anything. Like, I won't read the whole thing, but it says, a variety of security measures are applied to luggage and or persons of passengers selected through the screening process, including random searches. This random element prevents potential terrorists from, quote, beating the system, end quote, by learning how it operates, leaving out any group, such as senior citizens or other people such as clergy, would remove the random element from the system and undermine security. We simply cannot assume that all future terrorists will fit any particular profile. I mean, yeah, and then it goes worse than
so
that.
So we have to bust open your external hard drive.
Yeah, so they had to break the evidence trail to break your hard drive.
And again, if it was what they were afraid of, I don't think it was a very prudent thing to smash it open with a hammer.
Well, unless it was a monkey. It was a bomb monkey.
Well, I mean, I know they have equal opportunity employment, you know, it's like employment.
Well, then PETA would be all over that, too. They'd be like, you know, what, you're using a monkey to check for bombs and luggage?
See, that's what's so funny. They even brag about how they've done all this training ad nauseum in this little formula.
Trying to make you feel comfortable that they broke into your hard drive. Like, look, man, you're doing it for a good cause. Like, no, I want my freaking hard drive back, you know?
And all the one-of-a-kind information that was on it.
Well, see, that's the thing that gets me is, you know, you have to fill out a form. They have a PDF file, a TSA. And the thing is that form goes into a memory hole. Like, for instance, when I called the airline trying to find out who I could talk to, I got transferred to a line that was disconnected. I had to jump through hoops for a whole afternoon just to get as far as we got.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my. That's amazing.
But they did put a courtesy note in the suitcase that they didn't smash everything up in. You know, two checked bags. The bag that was violated got no courtesy card, but the one that was not violated did get a courtesy card placed in, just to let me know they looked through it again.
Yeah.
Man.
But the borders are wide open.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, but the heat and the lack of water keep them relatively secure.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess that's everything. Be careful. I almost got... I'll tell you a quick story. I had it's an old train transformer to apply power to the train tracks for a Lionel train set. And my dad gave it to me because we're into that kind of stuff. And I was bringing it back. And on my way back, just checking it, I checked it with my carry-on baggage. And, they're like, bag check. And, you know, they take it over here. And I'm walking over there. And, you know, and I'm like, oh, it's in that pocket there. And he's like, you don't tell me what pocket it is. And I'm like, okay, I'll socially engineer you to another pocket. And like, but, you know, they found it and they pulled it out. And he's like, well, what the hell is this? And I was like, it's a train transformer. I mean, it's old. It's metal. It's got three little things to attach wires to it. And it's got a dial, you know. And it looks pretty freaking scary, let me tell
dual
you.
Use.
Actually, that could be like a little timer thing for
I know. And it's
dual use.
Yeah. And so it's a transformer, too. So they got the coil in there and stuff like that. So, like, man, this thing's got coil. It's got a dial. And it's got little, you know, contacts to attach things to it. And he's like, this is for a train set? And I was like, yeah. And I'll see, he turned down, so it's lying down, you know, yada yada. It's got a plug and everything, and it doesn't have its own power source, so, I mean, it's not going to start on its own, you know, unless they start plugging those DC outlets in the plane.
It has a little sticker that says for children 12 and above on there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And too many, over 3 amperes can kill you, something like that. You know, so he puts it in the bomb sniffing thing, you know, it's like, you know, and I'm like, man, this thing's really old and dusty, and who knows, it can really smell like a bomb, you know, and I'm like, I'm never getting freaking home, thanks, Dad, you know, and then, like, he, like, puts it in there, and he, like, looks back at me, whoops, and then looks back at me, and I was like, oh, crap, and he takes it out, I was like, here you go, I'm like, all right, cool, getting on the plane. Oh, man, it was pretty scary.
But you can't take a Transformers robot onto an airplane. That's one of the banned items. I don't know why, but
carry
a Transformers robot. Wow.
Because it might hand-deliver something to three seats ahead of it.
Transform into a gun.
No, it's a dual-use device.
Yeah.
It's like, here's the thing. You can't take the little pocket knife, but you can carry the keys. Figure on that one.
Oh, yeah, because you can still put the keys in between your fingers and be even more effective.
And you can't take.
Don't say that. Now we're not going to be able to take our freaking keys anywhere, man. Thanks, VR.
Oh, you should be able
Kruger
to take
it.
So you can't take pens either because it actually has enough penetration depth to kill you underneath your ear. Let's see what other things. Oh, popsicle sticks are bad too. Pipe cleaners.
Shove it down their throat.
Anything can be used as a weapon.
Oh yeah. So let's. So we have to all strip down naked to get on a plane.
And handcuff each other.
Right.
So we can't punch each other.
Can be used as a weapon, too.
How effective
you could strangle someone.
Are you what I'm going to do then? I am going to get on the plane with a bag full of jalapeno peppers. I'm not saying nothing.
All right.
all right then.
Woo!
That was spicy.
Only MacGyver could have
I got that one.
Awesome. All right, well, I guess that's it. And I guess one last thing to add is that I forgot to mention the 2600 meetings meeting place has been updated. Check slipnet.org under meetings to find the new location, 2600 meetings in Arizona. And we're trying to get it resolved to where we have the updates on the 2600 site. We talked to Emmanuel Goldstein, and he said with enough of us contacting them, they should have it up by December. Really long date that changed. But that's the case. Well, this is Slip Mode signing out on another edition of the In and Out Show.
This is VR. Later.
This is Bob saying, down with SCO.
And this is me signing out with a public service announcement to those 2,600 members who congregate at the Arizona Mills Mall. Don't open those laptops under threat of security.
All right. See everyone in 2 weeks.
Join us now and share the software. You'll be free hackers. You'll be free. Join us now and share the software. You'll be free hackers. You'll be free. Borders can get piles of money, that is true, hackers, that is true. But they cannot help their neighbors, that's not good, hackers, that's not good. When we have enough free software at our call, hackers at our call, we'll kick out those dirty licenses evermore, hackers evermore. Join us now and share the software. You'll be free, hackers, you'll be free. Join us now and share the software. You'll be free, hackers, you'll be free.